Good evening, everyone. Good to see you all on this beautiful spring evening. And welcome to those who are here for the first time. This is the first night of a new Dharma seminar, which for those of you who are new, usually run 4 to 6 weeks on a particular theme. And usually I have a pretty good idea of what the next one I want to do is, but this time I was really waffling over two possibilities, both of which would have taken much more time than I had to prepare, and both of which I hope I will get back to, I will come to in the coming months. I'm not going to tell you what they are. Oh, maybe I will. I want to do something on Thomas Merton, and I want to do something on relationships, because we all have them, and we all struggle with them. So, relationship is a practice. You know, it's a really deep Dharma practice. So I really want to put more preparation into those. And then it really struck me what I want to do this third option presented itself with the gift to our Sangha, to our library, of this new book by Roshi Joan Halifax called Standing on the Edge, Finding Freedom Where Fear and Courage Meet. Hot off the press, hardback, you know, so you probably don't even have it. You probably may not have even seen it yet. So when our Sangha member Marley Hosho Ross donated it, I took the liberty of scooping it up on your behalf and bringing it home. And an initial look at the table of contents gave me the idea of using it. I thought it would work really well for a Dharma seminar series. I think probably we've all had times when we felt like we're teetering on the edge in life. Yeah? Yeah. She calls it the edge between fear and courage, which I really like, that formulation. It might also be the edge between success and failure, health and illness, mental or physical. Might even be the edge between life and death, ours or someone we love. It feels these days as though even the earth itself is on the edge, teetering on the edge. And that awareness affects us all. So Joan Halifax chooses six of what she calls edge states that she structures the book around. They are altruism, empathy, integrity, respect, engagement, and compassion. So I'm going to take a week for each of those. I'm not sure I'd call them edge states exactly. I think they're more qualities or capacities that support us when we're in an edge state, when we're close to the edge. But they're a useful construct for having the discussion, so we'll use it. What she does that I think is particularly valuable is to discuss both the wholesome and beneficial forms of each of these qualities, as well as the distorted or kind of shadow side, potentially harmful forms of each of these qualities, which ultimately each of those shadow sides is in some way shadowed or distorted by our self-clinging, right? Our self-focus. She also looks at how all those different qualities overlap and interact with each other, and she gives us practices that support each one. So it's similar to working with the Buddhist paramitas, the bodhisattva qualities that help us actualize our practice in the world. Most of you know that are familiar with them: generosity, conduct, energy, concentration, patience, and wisdom. I got them slightly out of the usual order. And how they interact and support each other. She does this with these qualities as well. Michael Zimai and some of the rest of the Sangha have practiced many years with Norman Fisher, who's going to be up here in a couple of weeks for a weekend retreat. And he's going to do... Oh, I have to put that on the website. He's going to do a reading at Banyan Books at 5:30 on the Sunday of that weekend to launch his new book, which is called The World Could Be Otherwise, Imagination and the Bodhisattva Path. And that in his new book, which I haven't even seen yet, and I hope will be on the shelves by then, is about the paramitas, the six paramitas that I just mentioned. So it'll probably be a good complement to what we're doing these weeks. It feels like these are senior Zen teachers, both of them in their mid-70s now, who are kind of distilling their decades of practice and wisdom in these books, offering their response to the very edgy times that we live in. So they're welcome, these books. Joan Halifax, some of you I'm sure are familiar with her and others may not be, but she, so I'll just say a few words about her spiritual biography, which very much reflects the eras that it spans. She was born in 1943 in New Hampshire. And when she was four, she suffered a serious viral illness that caused her to lose her eyesight temporarily. And she was 2 years recovering. So that that early brush with illness and mortality has been a factor in the lives of many spiritual teachers. Some early experience, either personally or, you know, losing a parent, that kind of thing, often sets people on a path of inquiry early on. During her university years, she became active in the American Civil Rights Movement and anti-Vietnam War protests. In graduate school, she studied medical anthropology and psychology and did field work with indigenous shamans in Africa and Mexico. And later she published two books on shamanic practices, one of which was the first I ever read of hers before I knew anything about Zen or before she was a Zen teacher. She had a brief marriage in the early 1970s to the psychologist Stanislav Grof. Together they studied the use of LSD with the dying and wrote a book called The Human Encounter with Death. Interesting, eh? Especially since just in recent years, research, actual legitimate research is being done on the use of psilocybin with to deal with extreme fear at end of life. She began Zen practice in the Korean tradition in the 1970s, later practiced with Thich Nhat Hanh in the Vietnamese Zen tradition, and received Dharma transmission from him, and then became a teacher in the Zen Peacemakers Order, which is a Soto Zen order founded by Bernie Glassman, who was the most entrepreneurial Zen master ever. I would say, but very much in the engaged Buddhism sphere of social action and environmental action. Joan Halifax founded Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico in 1990, again with an emphasis on engaged Buddhist practice, particularly in training people to in contemplative end-of-life care, also in prison chaplaincy, prison dharma. She leads still, in her mid-70s, volunteer pilgrimages to Nepal to serve in healthcare clinics in remote villages. I still have never met her, but from all accounts, she has the kind of leadership and drive that would have taken her to the top in other fields. but and is sometimes I think difficult. You know, she has a strong personality, but she's channeled it into a kind of dynamic Zen practice and teachings. Not without challenges. So when she tells us about edge states and the dangers of tipping into unwholesome manifestations, she speaks from experience, and she says, I'm not going to be able to more than scratch the surface. In some cases, there are a lot of stories that she tells from her own experience that you'll have to read the book eventually to get. But just to give you a flavor of her language, this is from her introduction. Edge states are where great potential resides, and working skillfully within these states, understanding can be quickened. Yet edge states are a fickle territory, and things can go in any direction, free fall or solid ground, water or sand, mud or lotus. Being caught in strong wind on a beach or a high ridge, we can try to stand strong and enjoy the view. If we fall off the edge of our understanding, maybe the fall can teach us how important it is to keep our life in balance. If we find ourselves in the mud of suffering, we can remember that decayed matter feeds the lotus. If we are pulled out to sea, perhaps we can learn to swim in the middle of the ocean, even in the midst of a storm. While there, we might even discover how to ride the billowing waves of birth and death alongside the compassionate Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So she's going to talk about not only these sort of elevated states, but what it is when we tip off the edge and how we fold that right into our practice. So let's look at the first edge state, quality, altruism. The definition of altruism, of course, is concern for and action in the interest of the well-being of others, free of self-interest. But even the experts don't fully agree on what constitutes altruism. Daniel Batson is one of the major researchers of altruism and gives a set of criteria. To him, an instinctive or automatic response can't be classified as altruism. He says there has to be motivation or intent behind the action. I'm not so sure you can draw such a sharp distinction, but more about that in a bit. So look at this. This is a huge tome on altruism by Matthieu Ricard, who's a Tibetan Buddhist monk who, when he was still quite young, left a very thriving career in physics and cellular genetics to become a Tibetan monk. But he's worked very closely with the Dalai Lama and the Mind and Life Institutes that interface between Buddhist practice and neuroscience. Anyway, he has written a 800-page book on altruism. And these, quoting Daniel Batson here, these characteristic or criteria for altruism. I'm not going to go over them all, but he acknowledges, interestingly, that altruistic and selfish motivations can be mixed, and often are, right? If we're honest with ourselves, can coexist in our minds and create a kind of motivational conflict when we start weighing our interests versus other interests, right? We've probably all done that. I'll say more about that in a bit. He also says sometimes we act in ways that are neither altruistic nor selfish, but out of a sense of maybe duty or respect for law. I mean, I still think then there's, you know, some self versus not, you know, underlying motivations to that too. But here's an important factor. Whether we, and to what extent, we carry through on our motivation into action can depend on other factors that are quite external and beyond our control, right? That doesn't fundamentally change that motivation, you know, whether it's altruistic or selfish, but there are contextual factors. Now, here's another thing he says, that altruism does not require a personal sacrifice. It can even have personal benefits or personal risks, but provided those benefits don't constitute the goal or our motivation of the motivation of our behavior, that there are secondary consequences. So the consequences, whether they're possibly even beneficial or possibly harmful, we might risk our lives, they're secondary to the motivation. The other main expert who has written the other major book about study of altruism, Monroe, a woman, she says that true altruism does require some risk. So it's there's not a definitive. There are questions. There are questions that are raised here. But he goes on to say, altruism can be regarded as authentic so long as the desire for the other's welfare constitutes the ultimate goal, even if our motivation has not yet been transformed into actions. So again, the other major expert says it has to be actually manifested to count as altruism. But by contrast, a selfish person considers others as instruments in the service of their own interests. They do not hesitate to neglect or even to sacrifice the good of the other when that turns out to be useful to reach their own ends. So that willingness to sacrifice others' well-being for our own interests is a primary mode that our culture teaches us, right? All the time. Sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists, philosophers have been debating for decades whether there even is such a thing as altruism, whether what appears to be selfless behavior is really selfish, in the sense that saving one's child perpetuates one's genetic lineage, or that sacrificing oneself for one's family or tribe or nation preserves that extended self-identity, or in the sense that we're motivated by some self-affirming desire for praise, affirmation, recognition, appreciation. Have you ever felt, oh, I did all that for him or her or them, and they never even said thank you, right? Hooked. Right? We do, and there's truth in these arguments, right? Because we do strongly identify with that extended sense of self. My identity, my family, job, team, culture, values. And we're less likely to extend our goodwill to those who lie outside that sphere of concern and care. But as human beings, as mammals, we are also deeply oriented toward what has been called a tending instinct, a caring instinct, because we nurture our children over a long span of time. And not just women, families. Do that. Extended families do that. Men and women do that. We care for others, the young, the old, the ill, the needy, each other. It's deeply ingrained in our human nature, as well as all the meanness and aggression. We see the roots of the tending instinct in other mammals and animals who nurture their young, and in social animals who rely on the group, right, for support. And it's learned. It's hard for orphaned and traumatized elephants or gorillas to learn to be good mothers, right? Because they didn't get to learn from their own moms. Just like us humans. We learn from our families and our society. And there are other ways of interacting that are than the self-centered way emphasized in our mainstream North American culture, urban culture. Ways that emphasize consideration of the well-being of others. At least those who are included within the group identity. That self-centered focus permeates our collective identities as well. You know, America first. The profit of a corporation's shareholders above the safety of its products. Happens all the time. That did not used to be the case. I read a really interesting article a while ago about how in the, you know, in the last century, late 19th, early 20th century, corporations had an ethic of responsibility towards society, not just towards the shareholders, and that actually legally changed. Who knew? So we have some work to do on expanding our collective as well as our individual sphere of caring. In many spiritual traditions, it's considered a high aspiration to extend one's care beyond the family or tribe to the stranger, just as we would our own family, right? I'm going to skip over here, a quote from the Bible. It's really good. No, it is. No, I'm not. Now that I said it, I have to. Okay, this is from the book of Matthew. And it's Jesus saying, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And he will answer and say to them, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And when I reread that, I had to Google it because I remembered just phrases from it. And I thought that could just as easily have come from an early Buddhist text. Don't you think? Yeah. You know, one of the texts on loving kindness and compassion. Matthew Ricard, who I just referenced, makes a distinction between what he calls natural altruism, which is that innate, often spontaneous, unmediated response to suffering, you know, to the weak and the vulnerable, and what he calls extended altruism, which is more impartial and for most of us does need to be learned and cultivated. It's that altruism that extends beyond me and mine, you know, to the stranger. Both in both these books that I'm sharing with you, there are interviews with those who selflessly came to the aid of others completely unrelated to them and often quite different from them. And they often say, I couldn't have done anything else. There was a need and I responded. These were human beings. In a BBC interview with Nicholas Winton, who in 1938 organized the transport of 669 Jewish children from Czechoslovakia to the UK. And he said, one saw the problem there, that a lot of these children were in danger, And you had to get them to what was called a safe haven, and there was no organization to do that. Why did I do it? Why do people do different things? Some people revel in taking risks, and some go through life taking no risks at all. So, it's hard to say. You know, you always ask ourselves, what would I do? What would I do if I were faced with that situation? Would I take the risk? We can't really know until we're faced. We may be, who knows? But in those moments of just full presence responding, there's a way that the self drops away. And we're just meeting that need of another. But of course, as we've mentioned, altruistic behavior can be contaminated by our self-interest, by self-inflation on the one hand, by our desire for acclaim and appreciation, or by self-deflation on the other hand, where we neglect our own being, our own well-being, or we think we're not good enough to be able to offer. Halifax calls these distortions pathological altruism, which I think is a little harsh. In their extreme forms, yes, for sure. But it can be more subtle than that. I think it's better to recognize that much of the time, altruistic and self-interested motivations coexist, as we mentioned. And that's our responsibility then, and it's our practice to bring awareness and conscious choice to which seeds we water, right? We don't have to flog ourselves if we have confused motivations. We just need to be aware of it and look into the roots of that conditioned roots of that. There are many people, many of us right here even, who work on a daily basis with human and environmental suffering, as teachers, healthcare workers, social services, the justice system, correction system, activists and frontline workers in human rights, humanitarian relief, environmental issues, not only professionals, but legions of volunteers, and other ordinary folks who care about humanity and plants and animals and the earth systems we depend on for our lives. All these people face the challenge of keeping heart and mind open and body healthy to do that work of healing the world. There's an old ancient Hebrew word called tikkun that means healing the world. Wonderful word. Rachel Naomi Remen, who's a physician, who has done wonderful work teaching other physicians about burnout and about humanizing their practice as physicians, offers a really useful distinction between helping, fixing, and serving. She says they represent three different ways of seeing life. When you help, you see life as weak. When you fix, you see life as broken. And when you serve, you see life as whole. Okay, I think I have time. When we help, we may inadvertently take away from people more than we could ever give them. We may diminish their self-esteem, their sense of worth, integrity, and wholeness. When I help, I'm very aware of my own strength. But we don't serve with our strength, we serve with ourselves. We draw from all of our experience. Our limitations serve, our wounds serve, even our darkness can serve. The wholeness in us serves the wholeness in others and the wholeness of life. I think there's overlap in these three modes. I mean, when you break your hip, you want a skilled orthopedic surgeon to repair it. You want it fixed, right? When you need something done that is beyond your strength or your skills, you need help. You need the help of someone with that ability to do the task. And you need the humility to ask for help, to receive that help. But if the people who do that fixing and helping do it with a sense of serving as well, with a sense of awareness that one day they might be, you know, the recipient, with that sense of real, this is my service to you, it gives a completely different feeling to the exchange. And then anyone who's ever offered as a volunteer knows, I used to hear it when I used to train hospice volunteers, and so often they said, I receive more than I give. I feel as though I receive more than I give. So this sense of serving, mutual serving, feeling of mutuality and connection, really I think is expressed in the word. Some of my favorite Zen words are the chant that we chant at mealtime. May we realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And emptiness here doesn't mean some kind of meaninglessness. It means profound non-separation, the interconnectedness of giver, receiver, and gift. So our human relationships become a continual flow of exchange. What obstructs that flow? I'd say two related hindrances obstruct that flow. Our sense of lack, of inadequacy, our need for recognition, approval, praise, money, success. The list is endless, right? And the other thing is our comparing mind. You know, we're always calculating whether we're better or worse or just as good, or are we giving or getting, you know, especially in relationships. Oh, you know, I gave all that attention and I'm not getting it. That calculating that we're always doing, weighing. Seeing the other as somehow a threat to me and mine. And this habit pattern places others outside our sphere of care. What's the remedy for these hindrances? Well, most simply paying attention, you know. Mindful awareness of when we close off, when we contract and separate ourselves from the world. And then stopping and breathing, just being present with ourselves and letting go. Even a little bit, that beautiful phrase, opening the hand of thought. Opening the hand of thought, of those constricting thoughts. Allowing some space for a more authentic, flowing, caring response. We don't have to become great dramatic heroes, jumping into freezing water to save someone from drowning. There are those who can do that. Not everybody can. There are countless small acts of courage that make a difference in this world. So Joan Halifax offers three practices for cultivating this capacity for altruism. And they correspond to the three precepts of the peacemaker's order, Zen peacemakers. Not knowing, bearing witness, and compassionate action. And to those three, I would like to add two more. That our teacher Norman Fisher encouraged Michael and me to take up when we ordained: humility and seeing all beings as Buddha. So not knowing is related to humility, right? It's knowing how little we know, not clinging to fixed narrow views, being willing to stop and listen to someone who has a different point of view from our own. Bearing witness is seeing the world as it is right before us, with complexity. Seeing all our ancient twisted karma arising in this particular moment, in this particular way, and then taking responsibility for our speech and action in the next moment. coming from a heart of kindness and compassion. And sometimes that demands immediate action, and sometimes it's a matter of staying still and not jumping in, just observing, making a space for compassionate witness, and trusting that others will find their own courage. So we don't have to wait until we're perfect bodhisattvas to engage in these practices. In fact, perfectionism itself can be a hindrance. We learn from our missteps. And if we risk nothing, we learn nothing. Mistakes are not tragedies. Without them, there's no learning or growth. So I'm going to wind up here. With a reminder that, you know, it's living right here in the muddy water of our daily lives that teaches us how to expand our circle of care, how to perceive the suffering of beings who are different or distant from us, and how to deeply value the infinite diversity of beings. So next week we're going to talk about empathy, which is essential for this capacity of altruism. But now, in our short remaining time, I do want to give you a chance to kind of share some reflections with each other. And so here's how we're going to do it. We're going to divide into groups of three. You're going to clump just with the three people closest to you as best you can. And then you're each going to have just 2 or 3 minutes to just speak. It's not a discussion. You're just going to listen carefully. Speak from the heart, listen from the heart. Here are some possible ways you could focus your reflections. You can think of a time that you acted in an altruistic way, and think if there was some way that your motivations were mixed. Your feelings about that were mixed in some of the ways that we've talked about, with some self-clinging, some self-interest. Another way to think about this is to think of an example of being on the receiving end of helping, fixing, or serving, and how did that feel? You know, if someone imposed a kind of fixing or helping that wasn't really, So think about how was it for you on the giving side or the receiving side, just in light of some of what we're talking about here. Okay? So there's no right or wrong answers to any of this. Just share what comes up for you with your neighbors. So I'm going to ask you to get in groups, tell each other your names, and then I'm going to ring a bell to get everybody quiet again. And then I'm going to ring a bell for the first person to start speaking, and then another bell to switch, etc. Okay, so quick, get yourselves arranged.